Section 5 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 2. Selfhood. Part 2. Sometimes, when slowly from the deep sleep of fatigue a man awakeneth, he lieth for a while amazed, aware of self and of his rested body, and yet knowing not where he is, bewildered, unable to interpret sight or sound, because of the slumbering guards in memory's castle have lagged at his summons, for to let down the drawbridge and to uplift the gate. Anon with our deliverance he cometh again to usual cognizance of the things about him, life, and all his old familiar concepts of home. So 'tis with any man-child born into the world, so wondereth he a while at the stuff of his home, so, though slowly and unconsciently, he remembereth. The senses ministrant on his apperception are predisposed to the terrestrial influences, adapted to the environment where they took shape. With ease of long habit, his lungs inhale the air, his eyes and skin welcome the sun, and his palate findeth assurance taking to the mother's milk. His muffling wraps, his frilled and closely curtained cot, and silken apparel of wealth, are stranger things to him than the rough contacts wherefrom they are thought to shield him, the everlasting companies of his lung syne. Nor later will he meet with any older acquaintance than these are. For his ancestors, ere they were men, had pillaged the wild combs, and through untold ages hive honey in cave and palace hath sweetened man's food. Not all the flooding syrup from the East Indian cane fostered in the Antilles, Ohio, or Illinois, in Java, Demerara, or Jamaica can drown Hybla's renown, nor cheapen the honey of Narbon. A jar of himatan from a scholar in Athens regaled our English laurel above all gifts to me, who have come to wiser affection in my regard for bees, learning the secret purpose wherefore nature planned their industry, and controlled its fashion to subserve the beauty and fertility of her vegetant life, to enrich her blooms with colour and fructify her fruits, which never a bee can guess. Not that the unwholesomeness of mixy pollen, a thing that so concerneth bees, was by the flowers contrived for their own benefit. Nay, whether it be in the gay apple orchards of May, when the pink bunches spread their gold hearts to the sun, nor yet rude winds have snowed their petals to the ground, or when a dizzy bourdon haunteth the sweet cymes that droop at Lammastide the queenly foliage of a tall linden tree, where yearly, by the wall of some long-ruined abbey, she remembereth her of glad thanksgivings and the gay choral sabbaths, while in her leafy tower the languorous murmur floateth off heavenward in a mellow dome of shade. Or when, though summer hath o'erbrimmed their clammy cells, the shortened days are shadowed with dark fears of dearth, bees ply the moor, issuing on sultry noons to throng in the ivy blooms, what time October's flaming hues surcharge the brooding hours, till passionate soul and sense blend in a rich reverie with the dying year. When and wherever bees are busy, it is the flowers dispense their daily task and determine its field, the prime motif, mayhap, of all bee energy, as of bee industry they are surely the whole stuff. Unwitting though it is, this great labour of love, in such kindly intimacy with nature's workings, hath a genial beauty, the charm whereof lacketh to the hireling drudgery of our huge city hives. So, for their happy demeanour and sweet ministry, they were ever admired of man, and won immortal place in divine story and in poetic fable and rhyme. Deemed heavenly visitants were they, children of the air, of no earthly engendering, under celestial laws, living a life of wisdom, pleasure, and diligence, a model for the polity and society of men. Alas, we have seen too near the poor life of the bee, how of the swarming workers that clustered to found the springtide colony and project its waxen walls, not one liveth to sing her Nisi Dominus, nor to rest from her labour, nor to enjoy the fruits. 40 days, 6 unsabbathed weeks of fevered toil, wasteth and wearieth out their little frames. In truth, their eggs were a mass product, not designed to endure, nor for themselves, but pennywise to serve a turn. One by one they succumb on their lonely journeys, all laden above their strength, benighted or astray, entrapped by swooping beaks, or by hard hail laid low with broken wings, until a frail remnant at last, wearily welcoming the dim prescience of death, seek their own cemetery, where their shrivelling skins may lie together, apart, nor soil the hive. Yet still, ever and ever as they fail, perish, and disappear, new shifts of younger workers, born of later eggs, take up the unresting labour, each in their turn, content to keep hive clean, eggs plenty, and storeroom full. Thus passeth summer, and with her draggled pageantry they too give o'er, and stay all business in the hive, and huddling upon the food store in their dark den, by numb stagnation husband the low flicker of life, sustained by an unheard promise that their prison again shall feel the sun, and they, with the brave buds of March, shall drink the valiance of his steepening rays. They too be heartened to revive, and venturing forth, renew the well-worn round of toil, wherein there is no one point of true accomplishment, since the sweet honeycomb, for which man thanketh them, is but their furnishment, the larder and nursery, and provisional shelter, wherein their forlorn hope, their last shift, may hold out through the long sleepless night of winter's starving gloom. And for their monarch queen, an egg-casting machine, helpless without attendance as a farmer's drill, by bedals driven and geared, and in the furrows steered, well watched the while, and treated with respect and care so long as she run well, oiled, stoked, and kept in trim. But if deranged she slacken in her depositing, she is dealt with, as men scrap a worn-out seed-barrow not worth the mending. New machines cost naught to bees. Now, when this story is with man's tender sentiment foolishly travestied, nature will seem malign. But bees, unless the selfhood of the hive can feel, lack conscience of emotion, and have no more than when, called by the sun to swarm in a bright morn of May, their agitated clamour and frolic flight would show that some levity hath pricked their cause. Even as with us, who feel the exhilaration of the voluptuous air that surgeth in our flesh to flood the soul and ease our stiff behaviour. And to such happy influences, swarming bees are responsive and forget to sting. In which, as in their stranger mockeries of mankind, they are truly less like us than we are like to them. So all barbaric tyrants, who secure their throne by murder of rivals, have their model in the queen bee, and the class hate that kindleth in disordered times, when prosperity hath set envy and desire at war, 'tis like the workers' annual massacre of the drones. And even if some faint rebel mote of pleasure lurk in these fly puppetries of human crime, 'tis plain that bees, in their short life, can have so little joy and so much toil. I say 'tis plain that, if the things be comparable, then with the beehive compared, the New World slave plantations were abodes of bliss. Meseemeth in my poem these poor hive bees fare as with an old black bear that hath climbed on their tree in the American Adirondacks or Asian Himalaya, and, clawing their comb, eateth it in, grubs, bees, honey, and all. It is all one to him, for the brute is omnivorous, and hath a sweet tooth. Conscient reason, the channel of man's spiritual joy, hath such dominant function also in bodily feeling, that 'tis the measure of suffering in all animals. In lower forms negligible, and in the lowest, pain can be felt no more than mid the dancing waves a pleasure boat feeleth the hand on her tiller that keepeth up her head to the wind and her sails full. And of spiritual pain the most cometh again through reason, whether of frailty or of imperfection. Savagery hath the throes, and ah, in tender years the mind of childhood knoweth torments of terror, fears incommunicable, unconsolable, vague shapes, though oft they be the dread boding of truth, against which man's full reason at grips may wrestle in vain. Yet for the gift to his virgin intelligence, a child is ever our nearest picture of happiness. 'Tis a delight to look on him in tireless play, attentively occupied with a world of wonders, so rich in toys and playthings, that naked nature were enough without the marvellous inventory of man, wherewith he toyeth no less, and learning soon the lore of cipher and alphabet, anon getteth to con the fair scholarly comment that science hath penned, glossing the mazy hieroglyph of nature's book. And as he ever drinketh of the living waters, his spirit is drawn into the stream, and as a drop commingled therewith, taketh of birthright therein, as vast a heritage as his young body hath in the immemorial riches of mortality. And now, full light of heart, he hath willingly passed out through the sword gates of Eden into the world beyond. He will be child no more. In his revel of knowledge, all the world is his own. All the hope of mankind is sharpened to a spear point in his bright confidence, as he rideth forth to do battle, a chevalier in the joyous travail of the everlasting dawn. There is naught to compare then, truly naught to compare, and were not fortune fickle in her loving kindness, all were well with the man, for his life is a flower, nor hath he any fear.
Pasensanatu nen, mnemonius sien, ananak me tosaute.
But since her favour is inscrutable and uncertain, and of her multiplicity she troubleth not at the interaction of diverse self-consequences, there will be blastings and blightings of hope and love, and rude shocks that affray. Yet to the enamoured soul evil is irrelevant and will be brushed aside. Rather 'tis as with art, wherein special beauty springeth of obstacles that have been overcome, and to graces transformed. So too the lover in life will make obstruction serve, and from all resistance gain strength. His reconcilement with suffering is eased by fellow suffering, and in pride of his calling good warriorship welcometh the challenge of death. Beneath the spaceless dome of the soul's firmament he liveth in the glow of a celestial fire, fed by whose timeless beams our small obedient sun is as a cast-off satellite that borroweth from the great mover of all. And in the light of light, man's little works, strewn on the sands of time, sparkle like cut jewels in the beatitude of God's countenance. But heavenward though the chariot be already mounted, 'tis faith alone can keep the charioteer in heart. Nay, be he but irresolute, the steeds will rebel, and, if he looketh earthward, they will follow his gaze. And ever, as to earth he neareth, and vision cleareth of all that he feareth, and the enemy appeareth, waving triumphant banners on the strongholds of ill, his mirroring mind will tarnish, and mortal despair possess his soul. Then surely nature hath no night dark as that black darkness that can be felt, no storm blind as the fury of man's self-destructive passions, no pestilence so poisonous as his hideous sins. Thus men in slavery of sorrow imagine ghastly creeds, monstrous devilry, abstractions of terror, and will look to death's benumbing opium as their only cure, or, seeking proudly to ennoble melancholy by embracement, will make a last wisdom of woe. They lie in hell like sheep, death gnaweth upon them. Whose prophet, sage, and preacher is the old ecclesiast, pseudo-Solomon, who crieth in the wilderness, calling all to baptism in the slough of despond. Vanitas vanitatum omnia vanitas. End of section 5.